Brett Hayes, I want to talk to you as a professor at Union College, our academic in residence here, our professor in residence. I'm getting a tremendous amount of mail from people who want to know about the Electoral College. They think it's unfair. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. We know that Al Gore won the popular vote, and on and on. So they want the Electoral College fixed. It's interesting. I know this is a long introduction, but I got almost no mail about the Electoral College during this election, and I think it was because everybody thought Hillary was going to do well in the Electoral College, so therefore don't bring it up. But a lot of liberals have brought it up now. Tell us what you know.
I mean, one of the things we know historically, right, is that the popular vote tends to align with the Electoral College. So while it has rather significant effects in terms of where candidates spend their time, it has effects on voter turnout, particularly in non-competitive states and the like. It hasn't had a dramatic effect on outcomes as we conventionally understand them. And so in that sense, we don't always talk about the Electoral College. We obviously did after 2000. And once again, here we are. But now we've had two kind of outlier elections where the popular vote is out of step with the Electoral College in the course of 16 years. It's a really short period of time. And that really does kind of, I think, raise this question about whether there is something kind of out of whack with the system that we have, something that has in many ways allowed a political minority to succeed in a what we conventionally think of as a national election, even though it's really not. And so in that sense, I think concern should be raised. But as I think we've talked about in past congressional corners, there is, of course, a major difficulty here with talking about the Electoral College, and that's the remedies. The remedies are extraordinarily unlikely to occur given the difficulty of first Article 5 constitutional amendment, which the most conventional path would require both houses of Congress to ratify the amendment with two-thirds majorities and then three-fourths of the states. Well, if you're a small state that's getting attention, or if you've been a swing state of late that's been
New
getting
Hampshire,
attention.
New Hampshire, a good example.
It's a great example. That you simply are not going to support that. And so a very small percentage of the states can effectively veto any type of reform.
Now, Brett Hayes, one of the fixes that I've heard about, of course, is that states, because they control their own election law, decide to do things like proportional, so that if Hillary gets 42 and Trump gets 58, you add those up, you divide your electoral votes, and every state agrees to do this, then you would have basically the popular vote, right?
Right. So there are some non-constitutional options. What we saw after the 2000 election was that there was an attempt to build a coalition of big states. So of California, Texas, Florida, New York, and a handful of others, Pennsylvania, Ohio, that would throw in all of their electors to the winner of the popular vote. And if you did that, it would effectively kind of nullify the Electoral College. But that never materialized, right? There are just too many people that are invested in the status quo. And if you can't get an agreement of like six or seven large states, it's really unlikely that you're going to get all 50 states then to agree on this proportionality plan. There have been proposals, for example, to allocate according to congressional districts so that you have a series and rather of kind of state level winner take all systems. You have congressional district level winner take all systems. But part of the problem there is that we know the House is terribly gerrymandered right now. Right. And it favors the Republican Party dramatically. So, you know, if you're in the Democratic Party, you would absolutely want to oppose something along those lines because it's not going to do you any favors. So, you know, we have to think about the Electoral College, not just so much in terms of the difficult pathway for reforms, but also like what would replace it and what that would look like in terms of outcomes and who benefits from it.
And whether or not it would put some of our most cherished institutions like a two-party system in peril.
Right. So I'm not sure that a reform to the Electoral College would, but there's, you know, anything that you shift away from the kind of first past the post or winner take all voting system tends to then favor multi-party systems. And of course, exactly. That would enervate the two great parties, as they're known.
I want to spend the next 4 minutes, if we can, Brad Hayes, while I have you here, on polling. Now, of course, I hate to say this, but I did call this election correctly. And I did look at the New York Times, who assured me that 83% chance for Hillary to win and very small chance. But then I would look on the, I would look underneath, and there would be every national poll which showed Hillary up one, Hillary up two, somebody else, you know, Trump up one. And I said, this isn't good. And that 40% that said they were going to vote for Trump never wavered, never ever. This group stood firm. During that time. So what did go wrong with the polling?
To be frank, I don't really know. I could give you a couple answers. There were a couple missteps, and I think in some ways you get the perfect storm. First, and I think most obvious, is that every poll has a model that they compare their results to, and they do this to try to ensure that the poll that they've generated actually captures a full cross section of the electorate. And usually that model is based off of the previous election, right? Or maybe several elections. But here the models are wrong because the last election was dramatically different, right? That we had a very different type of turnout. And so when you were kind of discounting or weighing certain voters in certain demographics to compensate, you actually were skewing your results. So there might have been an issue with the models. Another problem potentially was that they just didn't capture who was, or, you know, in large part, the true likely voters. You usually in polls try to work through this from multiple angles. You ask not just one question, you ask three or four to kind of triangulate that. It may have been that because people were turning out for Trump, who didn't necessarily regularly turn out, people that were identifying themselves as likely voters were actually not included in this category of likely voter, like saying, did you vote in the last election? Well, no, I didn't vote in the last election. That wasn't my candidate in there. And so you toss them out. And so the polls were skewed there. There may have been some things about the enthusiasm gap. There might have been some effects with the whole FBI. There's an issue. There's not an issue with emails. There were a lot of things bouncing around. And so some of those may have shown up at the end. There's not a lot of evidence right now for that, the shy Trump voter theory. And yet, there is this notion that we were surprised that white women supported Trump at the levels that they did. According to exit polls, and I think exit polling was also wrong in this in terms of what it was indicating early on, which is a little bit problematic to rely on exit polls. But exit polls also showed that Trump prevailed, I think, by 53% among white women voters, excuse me. And so maybe that then does suggest a certain unwillingness to admit that they would support Trump. So there are a variety of things that seem to have gone wrong, and there will have to be adjustments in order to rely on these polls in the way that we've come to rely on them.
Brad Hayes, thank you so much. Brad Hayes, of course, is Associate Professor of Political Science at Union College, has a PhD in Government and Politics from the University of Maryland.